financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rahm.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rahm. Hi.
Hi, Jess. Welcome back. How are you?
I know. I've been taking kind of a day off here or there, but I noticed that every time I take a day off, by the way, I blow a ton of money. So I probably need financial advice next time before I take the day off.
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking a day off and spending some money as long as you can afford it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, I notice when I take a day off, I pay for it when I come back. And that's the story of self-employed people. But still, it has to be done every now and then. Today, I wanted to talk about a way to leverage your money that people, you know, it's not really the first thing you think of when you think of, hey, how can I leverage my money? That usually points to some sort of risk, right? Risk and leverage. You know, I'm going to buy real estate and I'm going to trade one property up for the next and I'm going to keep doing it. And so people will say, well, you're highly leveraged. And they assimilate that as a risk. But in fact, this is quite, it's an incredibly safe way to do it. And I'm not talking about it specifically as an investment, but I led off with that because I want people to hear that message, that this is a way for you to leverage your money. This is a way for you to create generational wealth for not—
Okay, by leverage your money, you mean, what do you mean by leverage your money?
Turn a dollar into $1,000.
Oh, like that.
Like that. Okay.
Yeah.
But here's the kicker. You're not going to feel it probably. In some cases, you will be the one who reaps the rewards. But in other cases, it will be the next generation. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm talking about a way to create generational wealth when you think you can't afford it, maybe, or to protect your assets when you're well off and think, well, I'm just going to leave all my money to my kids. Who cares? They'll spend it. I don't care. You should be thinking about a way to protect your assets and leverage that and grow that into a much larger pot of money for not much money.
Okay, that sounds good.
Doesn't it? All right. Now,
yeah.
Here's where you hear the needle scratch across the record. It's life insurance.
It's life insurance. Life insurance.
Okay. Now, I don't talk about life insurance very often because even though I'm licensed to sell life insurance, and we write some policies every now and then for people that want them or need them, you know, clients. But I've not been a person who's been beating the drum about, you need to buy life insurance from me because I'm not selling you life insurance. What I'm talking about is a way for you to make your finances better for you and your family. Okay. So the first thing you think about when you think about life insurance is what?
Dying.
Dying. I mean, who wants to talk about this, right? We're all going to do it. None of us want to, and we're not in control of it usually. Okay. So when you're talking about something that has an emotional barrier to getting over a hurdle, this is one of them. Long-term care insurance is another. No one wants to think about being in a facility for the rest of their life. But the reality is many people will. A bigger reality is we're all going to die. Every one of us, no matter what we think, we will end our trek here on life by dying. The question, what are you going to do about that? What pieces can you control of that? And without getting into the whole emotional part of it, one of the things you can control is what happens after you're gone for your family, your charities, your partner in business, whatever, your cat, your dog. You can control some of this. And the way you do it well is through certain kinds of life insurance. Now, we can go through a lot of details about what kinds of life insurance there are and how you decide how much you're going to need and what you do with it. But at the core, what I want people to realize is that life insurance is a cheap way to generate more money.
Okay.
You might be generating it for yourself in the future as a stream of income, which could be tax-free, in fact. You might be generating it to leave behind to someone else.
But okay.
No, So many people ask me about this. They ask me about, well, I need a trust because I have this kid that, you know, I have two kids. One kid is really great with money, and the other child is, they're going to blow everything in a heartbeat.
Right. Yeah.
So
And you
I
hear about
want,
that all the time.
yeah. So I really want protection. I want to have a trust. Well, maybe they have so much money that they need a trust to get around some tax issues, and maybe they don't. If they don't, well, even if they do, I guess, but if they don't, the expense of managing a trust and the layers of putting a trust in place may or may not be in their best interest. And that's a question for an attorney. But one thing they could do through life insurance is they can, I hate to say this phrase, but in some way they can sort of moderately control their money from the grave, a thing that we're told we cannot do, right? We're always told, you can't do it. Once you're gone, they're going to do whatever they
want.
Yeah. Well, okay, so here's one little tidbit. You could have something on your life insurance called a restrictive beneficiary form.
Okay.
And that says how the person will receive the money. Now, there are limitations on it. Usually it's over a 5-year period or whatever. But instead of leaving your child, you know, $1 million instantly that they're going to buy a Lamborghini with or whatever, you could say, no, they're going to get it as a stream of income over 5 years. And the life insurance company, I always tell you these little known facts, right? When have you ever heard about restrictive beneficiary forms, right? But the life insurance company will administer that because it's
okay.
So one of the things you need to know about life insurance is that the death benefit is almost always a guaranteed thing. Now, there are variable life policies and universal life policies and variable universal life policies.
Yeah, it gets confusing.
Policies and term policies. And, you know, we could go on and on about the different kinds of policies there are. There are almost as many policies as you can think of. But for most of them, the core principle is death benefit. So when you're buying a life insurance policy, you're saying, here's X number of dollars. I want to buy this death benefit. Now, there will be, you know, probably a physical or some medical records, you know, that have been gotten from the MIB, the Medical Information Bureau, or, you know, or you may or may not qualify for that, or you may just be rated. So sometimes a lot of people will say, well, I'm diabetic. I don't know if I can get life insurance. Yes, you can probably get life insurance depending on the underwriter, right? Which company is offering it, based on your health. And so they might charge you a little more for your premium is what you pay for it monthly or annually, right? They might charge you a little bit more for your premium to offset their risk because of your health. But
okay.
that doesn't
that makes sense.
Get it. Right. There are even situations where you are, quote, uninsurable and you can still get a guaranteed issue policy, which we can talk about. Okay.
Okay.
So that core principle is providing a death benefit. Now, what that death benefit does is where it gets tricky. Okay. For instance, in term insurance, now let's talk about why it's so confusing for people when we say, oh, it's term insurance. And they say, oh, no, I think I have cash value in that. You don't. If it's term insurance, you don't have cash value in it. Term is called term because it only lasts for a specific term. So you might have a 10-year term policy or a 20-year term policy or a 30-year term policy. But at the end of that term, something major happens to that insurance. It could be that it just goes away completely. Or it could be that it is what we call guaranteed convertible. Again, these terms are tough, but guaranteed.
Is that guaranteed convertible to whole life insurance?
Yeah, to some form of life insurance that might be more permanent. Okay. So at the big umbrella, we have term and whole life, right? Term is the stuff that you don't pay very much money for, but it disappears at the end of the term. Whole life is somehow more expensive, but is more permanent. Now, under both of those umbrellas, there are, you know, a multitude of layers. For instance, under whole life, you know, that universal life, variable life, all those things, they're all some form of whole life policy, which is a term for, I hate to use a term, it's a name for a permanent policy.
Okay.
So permanent versus temporary. T for term, T for temporary. P for permanent. Okay.
Oh, so that's a good way to remember it. Yeah.
T for temporary. Okay. There's nothing wrong with either of these kinds of policies if they're the right one for you. if they're not the right kind for you, then you're going to be sorry that you bought them at some point in the future. Here's an example. You buy a term policy and you say, this is great because by the time this term runs out, my kids will be grown. And the kids are grown, but you've layered on a pile of debt. And, you know, your wife or husband has stopped working and doesn't have any income, and you now have no life insurance. You're going to be sorry that you didn't buy something more permanent to cover those. Or the other way around, you bought something permanent, you threw a ton of money into it. You said, I'm going to do this as some major retirement vehicle, and I'm going to save money in here tax-free. And it turns out that you never needed it at all. You know, you ended up with no debt. You prepaid your funeral expenses. You don't have children to leave it to, whatever. And you've sort of overpaid for that unless you choose to leave that money to a charity, for instance. Okay. So I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but I want people to just recognize. I'm going to talk about the power of banding briefly before we go to break. Okay. So the power of banding, when you're talking about life insurance, whether it's term or whole life, any kind of life insurance, companies give you a discount for banding. It's like wrapping your bills in $1,000 bills or $2,000 piles or $5,000 piles, right? When you take them to the bank, it's a lot faster to turn them in than if they have to start counting out your pennies, okay? So insurance companies band life insurance. So if you buy $0 to $25,000, it might be X number. It might be, let's say, $1,000 just to use a figure, right? And then if you buy from $26,000 to $35,000, it might be 88 cents a thousand, right? So the more you buy, the cheaper it gets.
The cheaper it's going to be, yeah.
In fact, here's one little known thing that I'll tell you. If somebody, let's say a life insurance agent comes to you and says, so Jess, how much can you afford monthly? What do you want to spend monthly? Oh, I could go on for an hour about why that's the wrong question. But
that's what car dealers do too, by the way.
Yeah. So when they say to you, what can you afford monthly? And you say $50, and they say that buys a $100,482.58 policy. Your answer should be either, I don't want to do it that way, or at the very least, I only want $100,000. Because for that odd number, you're paying a different amount.
Okay.
Right? Because of the banding. Okay. So if you know about banding, then you know that a $25,000 policy might cost you $50 a month, but a $250,000 policy will not cost you $500 a month, even though it's 10 times as much.
So you might be able to find that sweet spot where you're getting the rate that you want, but you're getting a little bit more.
You bet. And so we'll talk in the second half about how to decide how much money you need in life insurance and whether you need it or not. But just so that you have some idea at the beginning here of what you might be able to use to create generational wealth for your loved ones or your charity on a tax-free basis.
I want to get your phone number first.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
Or you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be right back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi,
Jess. You stuck with me through the whole dying thing and everything?
I did. Well, we're talking leveraging money, not life insurance. So I like that.
Yeah. So a lot of salespeople will try and spin it for you and say, this is really your investment vehicle. Let me start by saying it could be an investment vehicle. And for anybody who's really interested in that or wants me to take a look at what they've got already and give them an opinion as to what I think it is, I'm happy to do that. But in my experience, it usually takes a lot of money to make it a good investment vehicle, or you need to be very young.
Okay.
So when I see people who say, well, I'm putting $5,000 a year into my life insurance because it's my retirement fund, I wince a little and want to look at the policy. When they say I'm putting, you know, $200,000 a year into it, they might be funding that heavily enough if they have the time to make it work, to end up building an enormous tax-free pot of money that they can take out or they can leave to their heirs or whatever. But you just have to be careful that it's not a sales pitch, that you're looking at the math and you really see it on paper.
You just said something about either your one of two things, which one was extremely young. What is the best time to start thinking about buying life insurance? I think probably most people in their 20s and 30s don't think about it at all. Yeah. Or maybe they do. But when is a good time? When should you start thinking about it?
You know, the earlier you think of it, the better. In the old days, when we used to walk uphill and back, you know, both ways to school uphill, right? Yeah. In the old days, people used to buy policies for their children. And some still do. And that can be an incredible gift. You pay almost nothing for it. Mm-hmm. And you put, you know, let's say $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 on a kid's life. And you know, it gets paid off. Like, it's probably a permanent insurance policy, not term. And it gets paid off in full, and it just sits there and builds cash value. And maybe the child doesn't even know about it. And someday in the future, you know, they're getting married or they're buying a car or they're looking for a down payment on a house. And lo and behold, there's a few thousand dollars in there, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. much more than that. In some cases, I've seen it where the cash value exceeds the death benefit. And I have to say to people, wait, if you die, they're going to pay the death benefit, not the death benefit plus the cash value. Mm-hmm. So you want to take this cash value out now. And, you know, so while we're on that topic, let's talk about how you get the money out of life insurance, because you can cause yourself a real headache when you do this wrong.
Okay.
So I'm talking about the money being tax-free inside, say, a permanent type of life insurance, right? One that builds cash value. So you have your mm-hmm. death benefit, let's say $100,000. Maybe you have cash value of $25,000 in there. And you want to take some money out. Okay. If you withdraw the money and cancel the insurance, if you let the insurance lapse, mm-hmm. you no longer have a death benefit and the money you took out becomes a taxable event.
Oh, you don't want that to happen.
You really don't want to do it that way if you can help it. What you mm-hmm. want to do instead is to borrow the money out of your life insurance, at least pay the interest back every year so that the loan just stays level, right? Mm-hmm. So you can interest bill, you're paying yourself back, right? You're paying the interest on it, but you're keeping that loan level, because if, let's use that scenario, you have a $100,000 policy, you have a $25,000 cash value in it. Let's say you decide to take out 20 grand. You take 20 grand out and you die tomorrow, they're going to pay the $100,000 less the 20,000 that you took out, right?
Okay, so you're down to 80.
What you're doing is borrowing your own death benefit. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. You've got death benefit. They'd say, this is how much of it you can borrow. You're borrowing your own death benefit. But the law says you never have to pay it back. So that word borrow is a little deceiving. You don't mm-hmm. have to pay it back, but it will accrue interest. And if you don't at least keep the interest at bay, that loan will grow until such a time that it eats up all of the cash value.
Right. Yeah.
And either you have to continue to pay a premium that goes up, or you will have your policy lapse, thereby creating this taxable event for the money you took out. So the smartest way to do it is to keep paying your premiums, borrow the money out, and at least pay the interest on it every year so that you just borrowed some of your own death benefit. Simple. Easy.
Is it like a 401k though, where you have to have a specific life events in order to borrow, or can you borrow for any reason you want?
Great question. Yeah, it's yours. It's your death benefit. You're borrowing anytime you want, for as much as you want, up to the level they'll let you borrow. And it continues to grow. So the way that permanent insurance grows cash value, it's different from policy to policy. But in general, what happens is the amount of death benefit that you buy mm-hmm. then can, it doesn't always have to, but it can generate cash value within that contract. So think of it like interest on your savings account. The more money you put into savings, the more interest you make, that's available to you, right? Now, in a plain vanilla whole life policy, so not to get into the weeds on these sort of mongrel kinds of policies, which actually turn out to be a lot better usually than a plain vanilla whole life policy.
Sorry, I just had a sneeze.
Bless
okay,
you.
I'll cut that out.
Bless you. That's okay. you know, so rather than talk about those kinds of policies, let's talk about a plain vanilla whole life policy, which I almost never see anymore and definitely don't approve of as a first run thing, because it's the most expensive form of whole life you can buy, right? Most expensive form of permanent life. But to make it very simple, that policy generates a dividend, like a stock would generate a dividend, right? Only it's not a life insurance policy. So it generates a dividend. And there are several options that you can choose for that dividend. One of them is you can have it build up cash value. Another is that you can have it buy little bits of paid up insurance. So your $100,000 policy generates a $10 dividend, which buys $100 worth of coverage. And now you have $100,100 of coverage. And it continues,
and that adds up
over and over again. And that, in fact, can generate more cash value, interestingly enough. Another thing you can do that people don't talk about, and often we use this when people come to me and they say, we're trying to cut corners and we're paying $200 a month for this life insurance and we're thinking of canceling it. And I say, oh my gosh, you have a $250,000 policy here. You're going to cancel it for $200 a month. Do you know how many $200 a month payments you have to make to break even on your $200,000 policy? No, don't cancel it. Do this instead. And what this is we might change a dividend option on it to pay the premium. So if the policy is generating enough in dividends to pay part or all of the premium, you can simply do that. And the policy remain in force. The dividend will pay the premium. They'll send you statements. Just make sure it's in good health. So that
That's a great idea. Even if it cuts down on the payment a little bit, that helps.
Yeah. And the fourth thing typically, and again, some policies have different things, but the fourth thing typically that you can do with that dividend is you can say, send me a check. So if money's tight and your life insurance policy is generating a dividend, you could say, I want them to send me that $200 dividend every month or whatever it is. And your policy will stay in force and all of that. So the main point here is you can talk to your life insurance agent or you can talk to us, of course, about these details. What really know what your life insurance is. Don't think of it just like, well, it's just death benefit. And when I die, my kids get it. And I got to make sure the beneficiary is up to date. You know, really think about that. So, you know, you can have, you can use this for several ways. One way to use it is to preserve your assets. Look, I have a lot of money, or I have a house, or I have this situation where I'm going to leave my kids or my heirs pretty well off. Well, you can just do that. You can just let them fight over the money when you're gone, and you can do it that way. Or you could say, I want to put some life insurance on myself to free that money up for other uses. So what they're going to get is my death benefit when I die. Now, this can become particularly important in certain scenarios. One would be your partner in a business. And if you die, where is your partner? Can they, you know, have they lost half the clients? Have they, do they have double the expenses? Can they replace you? What is that like? And so oftentimes partners will buy life insurance on each other as key man policies or partnership policies to cover the other person. And that sometimes is just a term policy until retirement date, right?
And those policies will pay out if you die. You don't have to wait like a will and probate, right?
That's right. They avoid probate. Boy, you're really learning this stuff, Jess.
I'm learning from you.
Yes. Well, you're doing great. Yes, they avoid probate. So that money goes to your beneficiaries right away. Okay. So another place where this is really important, and I see this one often, somebody's got a lot of real estate or even just one house, but they want to leave it to their heirs, but they still have a mortgage on it. They still have taxes. They still have insurance. And maybe their kids don't have the money to cover that. And it's going to take 6 months, 8 months, a year to get through probate. What are you going to do about it? Well, you know what? That life insurance or an annuity could fund that. It could give them the money they need right away to make repairs on the property, to pay the mortgage, to pay the taxes and insurance. So they aren't forced into a fire sale situation, particularly at a time when they're least well equipped to do it, when they're emotionally distraught over losing a loved one. So there are, I think life insurance gets a bad rap. Even in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm going to talk about life insurance. You know, somehow it's become a, and I'm going to lay the blame at agents' doorsteps here. Somehow it's become a tool to sell people stuff rather than you should have in your portfolio. And so the reason I'm giving this sort of broad overview today on life insurance, you notice I haven't even mentioned like burial costs or anything, right? Is because I want people to think of it more broadly. So I promised to talk about how do you decide how much life insurance you need, because it's the number one question people ask. Well, how much do I need? I can afford this much. How do I get that much on what I can? Whatever. Okay. The way I recommend that you think about it is first you think about, okay, how much is it going to cost for my funeral? All right. Then do I have any income I need to replace? Am I leaving a partner that can't pay the bills if my income isn't there? How do I provide income for them, and for how long? Maybe they're going to need 2 years to get on their feet. Maybe they're going to need 5 years. Maybe they need it forever. Right. start to replace that income, and you can back out your expenses. Geez, they won't have my car payment if I'm gone, right? And so you add that in. Then you start to think about education. What about getting my kids to college? If I die prematurely, how do I fund that? Can I do it with life insurance? And you start to add those things that are important to you. And at the end are things like, you know, charity. I hate to say it's at the end because for some people it's at the beginning, but you know, you add in charity, you add in other kinds of expenses that you think you might want covered in your life insurance. And then anything over that is gravy. You know, you get to the point where you say, okay, I've identified a need, a phrase that salespeople love to use. I've identified a need for, you know, $500,000 worth of coverage. But it turns out I can buy $1 million worth of coverage. And in fact, that's going to generate a tax-free income for me at retirement. So I'm going to choose to do that. And then I'm going to borrow, you know, 400,000 of that money or 500,000 of it. And I'm still going to leave the rest of it to my heirs. Right?
Yeah.
So it's really an important tool to think about. And I hope that people got enough from this show, because it could be a 7-hour class and we would still never get through life insurance.
Yeah.
People got enough from this show to understand that this is in fact an important estate planning tool, not something you get in the mail and go, oh, I checked the box, I got 25 grand, that'll pay to bury me. If that's all you need, that's fine. But there are better ways to do it, I think. And having a real discussion with a pro who you don't feel is selling you a product or asking you, so how much can you afford, Jess? You know,
right.
Somebody who's really doing the work, who starts to talk to you about the kinds of things you've heard in this show, right? Somebody who's really doing that is worth having a solid discussion with about life insurance, because it might be the way that you create generational wealth for your kids, that you protect them from the costs of probate and keep your properties safe, you protect your assets, and you may generate some wealth for yourself in the bargain and use it tax-free. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. And I think that this is also a topic, like you said, there's so many different areas of it and questions and probably different ways that you can do things. I think that a financial advisor would be great for this, for help.
Yeah, for sure. And you just want to find one who is really asking you those questions about your life, not just numbers like, well, what's it cost you to live? And what? Yeah, you really want somebody who will talk to you about you and try and find the right fit for you, not some cookie cutter plan. Yeah.
And I like the tip too about, you know, when they ask you ahead of time, what amount can you afford monthly, to kind of avoid that, because you're right. You might say you can afford 50, but you don't need how much insurance that's going to buy. They're still going to sell you the $50 amount, the highest amount that you want to do.
Yeah. The biggest problem with that question is it is like a car salesman, and car salesmen get a bad rap too. There's some great ones out there, I'm sure, but it is like that. When you say 50, they know you mean 100. You know, they're going to push you to 100, whatever. And you know what they're going to do with it. That's why you gave them $50. But what you can afford monthly has nothing to do with what you need. The trick is to figure out what you need and then fit it into your budget using a variety of the techniques that are available under the different types of life insurances we talked about. You might end up with two separate policies or a blended policy to make it work. You know, you might grow from one place to another and add on every year. I mean, there's so many things you could do, but it's important to get what you really need or want first and then make sure it's affordable for you by doing the other kinds of work that you do about budget and all that sort of stuff. Yep.
All right. Well, let's get your phone number in case anybody does have questions on this or any other financial matter.
Yes, absolutely. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jess.
We'll be back again next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Would you like to see your business on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor? We offer a 15-year proven track record. We have limited openings, but are currently seeking sponsors and guests. Is your business a good fit? We'd like to start a conversation. Contact us today at 413-773-3333 or info@hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.
Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor. I'm Denise Fozella, along with Dr. Francis Ram of Hug Your Student Debt. This show is made possible by Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost, and by People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish. And this morning, we're talking with Dr. Francis Ram about something that is that all of us do at some point, and that is procrastination. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Denise?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It sounds a little negative, I guess, but I'm looking at it actually in a positive way. And believe it or not, some of the things that we have, some of the reasons that cause us to procrastinate can have a positive effect on us as well as a negative effect.
Okay.
Which was a surprise to me a bit.
That is a surprise, but I'm willing to play along with that.
Fair enough. I like everything to be positive if it's possible. But I am fascinated by this topic because of all the things that can get in our way about getting out of debt, it seems that procrastination is at the top of the list. And none of us, nobody comes into my office and says, I know the reason I'm in debt is because I procrastinate. They'll list it as one of many topics. You know, well, we had these things that happened to us financially, and then there was this problem, and then this other stuff happened, and I just kept putting it off. So I wanted to know, and I've been asking for years, what caused you to put it off?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people sometimes will tell us that they heard me on the radio or they saw us on TV for years before they came in. And they'll say things like, oh, I wish I did this sooner, right? And I'll ask, well, why? Why didn't you do it sooner?
What are some of the answers that you get?
Well, I was hoping to find one or two things that I could just point and say, if I can solve this problem, I can help people not to procrastinate. But it turns out that there are, you know, there's just a litany of reasons that people procrastinate. And so one of the things is that the goal might seem to be too abstract, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's just too vague. I want to get out of debt.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Weight. Mm-hmm. I want to be a millionaire. You know, it's just, well, I want to be a millionaire, I guess is a little more specific, but still not enough, right? So when we say, I want to get out of debt, it just seems like, who doesn't, right? But if we can be very specific and say, I want to pay my credit cards off in 2 years. I want to pay my mortgage off in 6. I want to have a budget I can live with. I want to do these specific things. And we do help people with that with coaching. But in the beginning, they don't know that. All they know is somebody's offering to help them get out of debt. And so I think this is in part why people fall prey to some of those programs that all you have to do is, you know, call up and sign a piece of paper and they're going to take care of everything and get you out of debt, because it's unthinkable about how you will manage that one piece at a time when it seems like an overwhelming goal.
So it's hard to connect with that goal because it's so abstract. And then it might be difficult to even comprehend the amount of debt that we have.
Yeah.
To face the goal.
Facing the goal is tough sometimes. It's why we ask people to put in their information in the website, and then they will see how much debt they actually have on paper, not just a sense of it, and not just saying, well, this is what I have in credit card debt, right? When they see what they're paying out in mortgages and student loans and car payments and all of that, then they can see it. And once we can see it, with a click of a button, they can see what their current timelines are and what our timelines are individually. So we can get very specific. And instead of being abstract, we can say, oh, look, there's your credit card paid off in 3 months. There's your car paid off in 20 months, whatever it happens to be. There's your mortgage in, you know, 6 years. And so then it's easier to move forward with the plan. But initially, just getting people to go and put information in the system, we all know, okay, we've got debt. Otherwise, we wouldn't be thinking about this. And that form seems really scary, right? There's a thing called form fear.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to put information into a form. So there's about a million reasons why people could procrastinate.
So many fears. Fear really sounds like it's at the root of procrastination. And avoidance is one of those ways that fear gets manifested. I remember, and I'm not going to say who, I don't want to throw this person under the bus, but I remember as a child seeing somebody's mail piled up on the table, bills unopened. Did not even open them to see what they were. And if the phone rang, it was not answered because it was a bill collector.
Yes. So I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say that person also suffered from some anxiety. And there's something called a feedback loop. When anxiety is present,
and it's a task that they really don't want to look at, and they procrastinate, the procrastination causes them to feel more anxious, and there's this awful feedback loop. And the longer it goes on, the stronger the aversion is. And stacked up bills is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, now on the other side, you could say is there's that lottery idea, right? As long as I don't open the envelope, I'm a wealthy person, right? As long as I don't open the envelope, I don't know what that bill is. And so, believe it or not, there's also a thing about procrastination that people put it off for a sense of excitement, if you can imagine that. So think of a student who will not cram for a test until the night before.
Oh, right.
Because they see that process as being tedious or boring, or they don't think they're going to do it well. And somehow waiting until the last minute causes the excitement to grow, and very often can cause a positive result as well as a negative result, depending on the person and how they process that.
Brings about an adrenaline rush in a way.
I guess so. It's not something I do. I personally like to get my ducks in a row and have them done. But, you know, we all have these reasons we procrastinate. One of the most interesting things I thought was optimism. Optimism can cause people to procrastinate.
And how so?
Well, you think, okay, this is a problem now, but I'm going to get a raise soon, or my business is going to do better, or after I graduate, I'm going to make all this money. So I'm optimistic toward the future, and that means I don't have to look at getting out of debt now, because it's all going to be okay someday. So I tend to be an optimist. I tend to have, you know, lots of fresh ideas, and I always want to put off whatever I'm working on now to get to the next fresh idea. So the whole underlying issue here is our behavioral patterns, right? Our sense of self-control and willpower. And I think most people would say, oh, if you procrastinate, you don't have good self-control or you don't have good willpower. But I would say that that might only be true in a certain area. You might have great self-control or great willpower in other areas of your life. Maybe you're terrific at your job or with your parenting skills or, you know, helping other people. But when it comes to your own stuff, your own finances, it's just too icky to want to look at. And so we put it off.
And I certainly did that as well. You're listening to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. And I am her co-host, Denise Vozella, the news director here at WHMP. And it took me at least a few months of hearing your commercials on our radio station before I called you. And then I had to go home and have that conversation with my husband before we called you, that I told him, explained to him what I heard in the commercials and what I thought this might be able to do for us. I brought it up before, that lifeline that we were looking for. And so even I procrastinated in calling you.
And think about that, because you were really very close to the situation. You knew there was credibility because I was here at your station, right? And even with that, there's still that obstacle. There's still whatever reason it is. And I think it's different for everybody. I mean, there's lots and lots of reasons. One of the things that I thought was very interesting is that we might see the problem as happening to a future self, and we don't have a real connection to that. So an example would be, my doctor says I have diabetes, and if I don't change the way I eat now, 2 to 3 years from now, I could have a real medical problem. Okay, so I might perceive that, if I'm good at procrastination and denial, I might perceive that as something that doesn't have a sense of urgency, it doesn't need action right now, it's going to happen to me 2, 3 years in the future. And I almost see that as happening to a future self.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if somebody said, you have a medical problem that requires you to change your diet, this is what you need to eat now, very specifically, and you need to do it now or a week from now, you're not going to be here to tell us about it, then that might cause me to take action immediately and not procrastinate so much. Unfortunately, with debt, it's less, I think it's still life-threatening, but it's less medically life-threatening. And so even though people know, okay, this is really coming to get you and there's a problem, until people reach what they perceive as the bottom, the rock bottom, they don't move to get out of debt. Now, for some people, rock bottom is just that they just can't send any extra to their debt this month, and that disturbs them. And other people have to have, you know, a letter telling them they're going to court. But that's what happens when people, you know, don't have a connection with our future self about the debt.
So what do you do about that? Other than picking up the phone and calling you or going to your website and filling out the form.
Sure. Well, what one thing you can do is you can take something like that that might seem overwhelming, for instance, or seem abstract, and break it into very specific pieces and begin to make a plan. Now, you don't have to make the whole plan, right? That's another thing we procrastinate about, believe it or not, is this idea of perfectionism. Okay, we're going to get out of debt. Let's sit down and make the plan, and it must be right from the start, and mm-hmm. let's make sure we read all the books and we do all the stuff. Just take one step, one tiny little step. Whatever it is for you is okay. If it happens to be calling us, great. If it happens to be just sitting down and saying, today, I'm going to track all the expenses I spend, and I'm going to start to get a handle on what I'm spending. Tomorrow, I'm going to go and fill out a form online. On Wednesday, I'm going to call a coach. On Friday, I'm going to call an attorney. Whatever it happens to be very specific about it and make it immediate. Make it so that you're doing it right now. Because after you just make the very first step, the rest of the stuff gets easier. It falls into place.
Once you take that first step, I've heard that that can create motivation to keep going, right?
Yeah.
That it gives you that inspiration. Oh, I've done this. Now I can do more.
That's absolutely true. You know, we're talking about self-control and willpower, and those are the things that can get in our way, right? There can be demotivating factors. Things like, I'm just exhausted when I come home at the end of the day, and I keep telling myself I'm going to fill out the form or get out of debt or do whatever, but I just don't have it. I'm done. I'm depleted, right? So every time you make decisions like this, you're depleting your mental reserves a bit. And when you're trying to make a lot of decisions, you are exhausting your mind to some extent. And so until you recharge your batteries, you're not going to be able to really get out of debt the right way, right? So one thing you can do is figure out when you're best. If you're best in the morning, don't put it off until the end of the night. Take a morning on a weekend or sometime when you can and start working on it right away, but only do little bits at a time.
Great advice from the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. And we are going to take this quick break. We'll be right back with part two of our conversation about why do we procrastinate so long about getting out of debt. Welcome back to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. I'm your co-host, Denise Fozella, and we thank the people who make this show possible. People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish, and Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost. This morning, we're talking about why we procrastinate so long about getting out of debt. And it's something a lot of us do. It's almost universal, isn't it, Frances?
I think procrastination in general, you know, is just an interesting topic because we all do it. I do it. Nobody's immune to it, right? And sometimes it has a positive effect and sometimes it has a negative effect. Some people, you know, if they're afraid of being judged, which is one of the reasons we might procrastinate, that can drive them toward solving a problem. I don't want my relatives to see my name in the paper that I couldn't pay my bills one day and I had to file a bankruptcy, so I better get on this and get out of debt. But most of the time, I think the fear of being judged or, you know, any of the fears that we have get in our way. And it's just very difficult to overcome those until there's some catalyst, there's some reason that you suddenly feel, okay, today is the day I have to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would prefer to have people not feel that way, not be pressed into it, and start to see this as a positive approach to money management.
I think
that would be great.
That there's also, in some cases, a fear of deprivation, that if I take this step, then I'm not going to be able to do the things that I want to be able to do. And I don't
right.
want someone else telling me what I can and can't do with my money.
Right.
So there might be that kind of fear of control, a lack of control.
So that's why I'm the money doctor and not the money monster. Okay.
Yes.
Because I had this problem. I was in a lot of debt, and I had to be able to get out of it. And I didn't want to sacrifice my lifestyle. So what we did was create a system that could get you out using the same money you're already spending and sometimes less, right? Sometimes I look at people's numbers and I just say, you know, no wonder you're taking on credit card debt. You simply have been loaded up with too much debt. Your payments are too high. And so we have to adjust that. So I think, ironically, people expect that the first thing we will say is, okay, don't use your credit cards, freeze your debt, You're now on the ramen noodle diet for the rest of your life. And by the way, no vacations. You're not going to buy a car. And this is what you're doing for the next 8 years. If you want to get out of debt, you must live in privation. And the truth is, we know that won't work. That's a foolish way to go at it. In order for someone to have a successful debt plan, they have to be able to live a decent lifestyle. They have to feel better about their money. It's the same as a diet. You cannot lose weight long-term on some diet that is unrealistic. And you know there will be a birthday party or the holiday where you're going to want to eat that food and has to be allowable. So it isn't that we tell people you can just spend willy-nilly and still get out of debt. That would be ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't have to worry that we're going to cramp their lifestyle because we're really working with exactly what they have now.
I think also there's a lot of anxiety around this whole thought of getting out of debt. I mean, what does that even mean? We spoke earlier about wrapping your mind around that, but it creates a lot of that kind of anxious feeling.
Money in general, I think, I find creates that for people. Even if they think they're very good at investing, there might be a part of the financial picture that they're not happy about, like the debt, or speaking to their partner about it, and that really elevates our emotions. And so whenever, you know, it's sort of the fight or flight thing, right? Whenever we're faced with something that's very dangerous like that, or we perceive it as being very dangerous, it all seems larger. Everything seems magnified. So you were talking earlier about you had a conversation with your husband about, you know, getting out of debt. And I know we're going to get your full story someday because you've offered it to us.
Yes.
But, you know, just leading up to that, the conversation itself is almost never as scary as we think it will be. When, you know, we're thinking about getting out of debt, it just seems overwhelming. And really, it can be done very methodically. And the odd part is staying in debt is the what should be really, really overwhelming. But because we're already there and the payments go out every month, you know, we just let it go on, and taking action to get out requires a little courage.
You're reminding me of some of the things that I've gone through with regard to money in my lifetime. And one of my fears has been in the past that I can't face it. I don't have it in me to face everything. So it's just too overwhelming.
Yeah. And that can be true not only in a general sense, but in a very specific sense. Like we call it task aversion. The best example I can think of in terms of money is usually building a budget. Most people, when you say the word budget, will just about run screaming, you know, because it conjures up this image of, you know, I use this analogy, trying to cram a size 12 foot into a size 9 shoe, right? And so the task seems so awful, we don't want to do it. Who wants to have that terrible medical exam that you didn't really want to have? But sometimes you're forced into that medically. But with debt, you're not so much forced into it. And it can be really scary. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that the perceived reward is so far out in the future. Sure, I'd love to get out of debt, but gee, 10 years seems like a long time, or 5 years seems like a long time. We don't really see it as, okay, I want to get out today. I pick up the phone, I make a phone call, and I'm out of debt. Problem solved. Check the box, move on, right? Mm-hmm. It takes some, my mother used to say moxie, right? It takes a little moxie, that's a really old word, to face it, right? But what are your alternatives, really? I mean, you can stay in debt for a long time, and you can continue to try to get out of it, trying different things, and maybe you'll be successful and maybe you won't. But even that compounds it, Denise.
What I have found in every single case that I've ever faced something that I was afraid of, the fear was much worse than the reality, and it actually facing the issue, and money has been definitely right up there. Facing it has eliminated a lot of the anxiety.
Yeah, facing it and having a solution.
Yes.
So just facing it is a little
step
bit like
one.
Yeah, it's a little bit like hitting your head on that brick wall. You know, most people who have debt have faced it many times. And the reason they might have a fear of failure is because that's the reinforcement they've gotten. I tried this. It didn't work. I ended up back in debt. I tried that. It didn't work. Here I am again back in debt. Every time you do that, your resources are worn down a little bit more and a little bit more, and you become more suspect about whether you will ever be able to accomplish that or not.
Your emotional resources. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And when you think that you might fail, that fear of failure is enough to procrastinate. I don't want to look at that. Okay, here's a great example. A student might procrastinate about taking the exam and might fail the exam rather than studying for the exam, because they would almost rather that the procrastination, the fear of taking the exam, the procrastination was the reason to blame instead of they didn't understand the material. People will perceive all of these things as, you know, a series of huge hurdles. You know, I'm afraid to face this. I feel really anxious about it. So there's the anxiety.
It's overwhelming.
Part. There's the task, right. It's overwhelming. There's the task aversion. I really hate to look at money. There's the form fear. I don't want to fill out a form because I'm afraid somebody will have my information. I might fail. So I'm not sure I want to do that. I'm going to have to call that person and I'm going to be judged. They're going to tell me that I didn't make good decisions or, you know, so we try to remove all those obstacles. The thing that makes it work for people is if they can just get over the hurdle and begin to take the steps to get out of debt, fill out the form or call us or whatever, then you're going to get a coach who is experienced, who went through what you're going through right now, because I don't hire anybody that won't, that hasn't been a client, right? So they've been through what you've been through, and they understand it, and they'll listen and help you with whatever it is that might be happening for you in procrastination, because we're all different.
So motivation can start to happen. Motivation to stop procrastinating can start to happen when you just take one step.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's no doubt about that, that any one step is progress. It doesn't have to be the whole plan. One of the things that we say in the investment world, and it's true in debt as well, is that people suffer from analysis paralysis. I want to get out of debt. It seems like such a big project that must mean it requires a lot of effort, a lot of research, a lot of planning, a lot of time. And so I go out there and I want to make the perfect decision. I want to make sure I'm not getting ripped off, and I want to make sure that I have the best debt plan possible. And so I read and I read and I read and I send away and I talk to people and I fill out forms, but I never quite pull the trigger because I'm not sure which one's the right one. And that's like saying I don't start my diet because I'm not sure which diet I want to start. Any diet would help you get to your goal, right? And it's the same with debt. Just start to do something, anything, toward changing the direction that you're going in.
And I want to ask about the having a partner in this process, a spouse or a living arrangement, someone that you have, that you share debt with, that you have to get on board. And what if they're the procrastinator? How do you overcome that?
Well, there's always divorce, you know. No. So what can you do? Well, you know, you can do a few things, I think. And I don't profess to have all the answers to this. I just want to help people.
And you have helped a lot of people. You've seen a lot of cases.
Yes. Yeah. Thousands of people for sure. So what can you do? Well, it depends on the spouse and it depends on your relationship. If you have a good, solid relationship and you can have this discussion, make it a pleasant discussion. You know, it's not drudgery, you know, make a nice dinner. It's not a surprise attack. Tell them in the beginning, I've got a problem. I'm managing the household finances and, you know, I don't want it to be scary, but you know, we've had a conversation several times about doing something and we can't quite get there. And in order to get there, I think we have to agree on what direction we're going to take. So can we talk about it after dinner and, you know, and even say, look, I'll handle the bulk of this because I'm the one doing it, but I need you on board with me. And see what they'll say. Usually people are pretty happy to help rather than be in the doghouse. Yeah. Yeah.
So we are talking about procrastination with regard to getting out of debt with the Money Doctor this morning. And how can people contact you, Dr. Frances Ram? And what can they expect when they get someone else on either on your website or on the phone?
Sure. They can reach us at 413-774-5555 or 773-3333. Or on the web at hugyourstudentdebt.org or powerdowndebt.com. And what they can expect when they get someone on the phone is that there will be a live person. You won't be stuck in a phone tree. If we're not available right at the moment because we're in session, we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. But you'll get a real person to talk to who will be firsthand knowledgeable about what is going on for you and can answer any questions and schedule a consultation for you or a webinar or whatever is appropriate and whatever works with your schedule.
Thank you, Dr. Frances Ryan of Hug Your Student Debt. This has been Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, made possible by Greenfield Community College, increasing access to higher education at a fraction of the cost, and by People's United Bank of Amherst, home of Tea with Trish. If you missed any portion of this program or want to hear any of the programs in this series, you can hear the podcasts all at WHMP.com. I'm Denise Bozella. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We'll be back again next week.
Have you heard about Get the Tea? It's an online herbal supplement company with high quality standards. You cannot find these in stores. They carry cleansing teas and targeted herbal supplements for all your health needs. Go to getthetea.com today to order yours. Health shouldn't be put off. It should be a priority. And check out their specials page for sale items. That's getthetea.com. Enter code TEA123 for 10% off exclusively for my listeners. Getthetea.com, code TEA123. Order today.
This is Frances Rayum, the Money Doctor. Now you can become 100% debt-free, budget successfully, and retire well, all under the Hug Your Money umbrella.
She had two IRAs that were worth approximately $25,000, and she closed them out to pay off credit cards.
I was desperate.
And I really believe that's when she said, I got to do something, because that was going to be part of our retirement. And the next thing was going to be is, am I going to turn in mine?
I never, ever considered cashing his in.
No, but I did.
And I thought, okay, you're obviously never going to do this on your own, Jill. It's not working.
Once she started paying the credit cards off and seeing results, then she was happy with Hug Your Money. I felt relief.
Debt, budget, retirement. Hug works best when we work together. Schedule your free consultation with a Hug Your Money coach today. Visit HugYourMoney.com. Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented.